ければ。
Welcome to the fourth episode of The Definitives, a limited-time music podcast detailing the makings and legacies of some of the greatest rock albums ever made. I'm your host, Blake Peterson, and today we'll be talking about Live Through This, the second studio album by the American rock band Hole. One of the most popular movies at the 54th Golden Globes was The People vs. Larry Flynt, a 129-minute biographical black comedy directed by Milos Forman. The movie is a half-joking, half-dead-serious account of the life of the eponymous Larry Flynt, who, if you don't already know, was the founder and editor of the popular pornographic magazine Hustler. For a film revolving around such a provocative subject, it's surprising that it was not its central figure or its storyline that was most discussed upon its release. Consider these things number 2 and 3 on an unofficial list of conversation starters. Most remarked about was the performance of Courtney Love, who plays Flynt's wife, Althea Leisure. At that point, Love, among the most despised celebrities, had acted a handful of times. Toward the end of the 1980s, she worked as a supporting player in two Alex Cox features, Sid and Nancy and Straight to Hell, and was briefly seen in 1988's Tapeheads, in which she plays a character simply listed as Norman Spanker in the credits. Yet it felt as though Love was making her acting debut in The People vs. Larry Flynt. Perhaps, though, that could have something to do with the fact that she had never been so prominently spotlighted in a movie before. Even then, her being so excellent in the movie was something of a surprise for audiences in 1996. In the years previously, Love had been, to say the least, a controversial public figure. Her struggles with drug addiction were partially persona-defining and were frequently chronicled by the tabloids. She was prone to doing and saying inflammatory things. She was a shameless provocateur. Most definingly, though, she was the widow of Kurt Cobain, the frontman of the era-defining grunge band Nirvana. This association has been a damaging one. Because her band, Hole, released their second album, Live Through This, just a few days after Cobain killed himself in April 1994, Love was and continues to be both accused of being an uncaring wife and an opportunist who used her husband's death to bolster her fame. She was, and is, pretty universally disliked by the public. Her talent was and is often questioned. But with The People vs. Larry Flynt, even those who disliked Love could not deny she had star power. Her starring in the feature seemed like kind of a kiss-off. Here she was, a controversial person, in a movie about another controversial person. In the film, we see Love grow from teenage stripper to drug-dependent wife to tragic figure, not unlike Love herself. The performance is nuanced and impactful. Roger Ebert remarked that she was a true actress. Love was nominated for a Golden Globe and several other awards for her supporting work. She might still have been a Yoko Ono sort of figure in the eyes of many, but the general public couldn't deny that she was talented. Granted, I'm saying all this without having been alive when it all went down. I never actually experienced what it was like to see Courtney Love at her peak in the 1990s. I know mostly everything from books, articles, and interviews, and from older family members who, to this day, make a noise of disgust whenever I so much as bring Love up. But I know that Love is gifted. And even though myriad decisions she's made over the course of the last few decades are agitating and undeniably problematic, she is a figure who I think has been pointedly misunderstood. When I say pointedly, I mean that there continues to be a widespread unwillingness on the part of the public to give Love's output a real chance. This is understandable, I suppose. Like most people, I too rarely give artists with whom I frequently disagree a listen or a look. But what bothers me about the way the public has treated Love is rooted in the reality that, because perception of her is so negative, there is a lack of appreciation of what she did well. She was a great actress, The People vs. Larry Flynt proved that, and she was a great singer-songwriter too. Yet giving her credit almost seems taboo. Some fervent Nirvana fans believe that Cobain was responsible for writing all the songs on Hole's Live Through This. There are feverish whispers that Love attempted to hire someone to kill Cobain, and that she was much more involved with his death than she had been letting on. People just loathe love in general. Of all the untruth things said about love, though, I've always thought the accusations that Cobain wrote all the songs on Live Through This were the funniest. People who abide by this belief don't realize that, by saying this, they're actually indirectly complimenting the woman they hate so much. These songs are so good, they're essentially saying, Cobain must have written them. But Cobain didn't write them. Love, collaborating with Hole's guitarist, Eric Erlandson, did. And so we're left with a bunch of naysayers declaring through their gritted teeth that yes, Live Through This has a lot of good songs on it. Though I think Hole's first three albums are all great in their own way, Live Through This, widely considered the band's masterpiece, is the one which stirs me the most. It is also a nice meeting in the middle of the three sounds Hole presented on each album it made in the 1990s. Pretty on the Inside, from 91, is hardcore and purposefully ugly. Here is its opening track, Teenage Whore. The album the band made after Live Through This, Celebrity Skin, was a rock-pop hit defined by its title track. Here's part of that song. Oh, make me over. I'm all I wanna be. A walking study. Live Through This is like the center of a Venn diagram. It's catchy, but rough around the edges. A devastating chronicle of female anger that astutely attacks misogyny, classism, motherhood, and more. Its fury is so corporeal that, no matter when I'm listening to it, I can almost instantaneously snap into the sort of indignant state love is in for its runtime. Just listen to the third track, Plump, which always gets me worked up. Of all the LPs I've talked about thus far on The Definitives, there has yet to be one that isn't fairly beloved. Despite being acclaimed by so many, and despite its commercial success upon release, Live Through This makes for an exception. It is a point of contention for a lot of people to this day. It's a masterwork people have an aversion to. Fortunately, I don't possess any of that hostility. In the fourth episode of The Definitives, I'm going to talk about the pre-stages, making of, and aftermath of Live Through This, Hole's crushing, perennially underrated second album. Hole was officially formed by Love in 1989, following stints in bands like Faith No More, Sugar Baby Doll, and The Pagan Babies. Having taught herself guitar toward the end of 1988 and wanting to pin down a long-term musical project, Love placed an ad in a Los Angeles zine. She wrote that her primary influences were Sonic Youth, Big Black, and Fleetwood Mac. First joined guitarist Eric Erlandson, a college graduate, Buddhist, and son of a dean. Love was initially reluctant to let him in because he wasn't a woman. Then came her neighbor, Lisa Roberts, who would act as the group's bassist. And then Caroline Rue, a drummer Love had previously met and taken a liking to at a Guar concert. There was originally a third guitarist, Mike Geisbrecht, but but he soon departed. Love helped support the group financially by working at various strip clubs in the area. Recognition, at least on the cult level, came pretty swiftly. By the end of 1989, Hole started playing shows. Then it put out two singles, Retard Girl and Dick Nail, the first in 1990 and the second in 1991. Each single was respectively released by Sympathy for the Record Industry and Sub Pop Singles Club. In a matter of a few months, Hole would be featured on the front cover of the Flipside fanzine and got airplay on local Los Angeles radio stations. Though listening to both songs, it's kind of shocking that Hole was taken seriously so quickly. While both Retard Girl and Dick Nail are lyrically heavy and interestingly condemnatory, to call them abrasive would be an understatement. Here's part of Dick Nail, a song about sexual abuse which Love called a, quote, anti-misogynism anthem, and you'll hear what I mean. To produce the band's debut album, Love enlisted Kim Gordon, known for her groundbreaking work with the ever-exploring rock band Sonic Youth. On January 1st, Love sent Gordon a letter, which addresses Gordon as Miss Kim, with a little upside-down heart next to it, in which she succinctly asked if Gordon would be interested in producing. She sent the group singles and a Hello Kitty beret alongside the note. Love had admired Gordon's body of work, and wanted her, not least because she was a woman, to be one of the driving forces behind the LP. Gordon agreed. The album, Pretty on the Inside, would be recorded in a little less than a week in the spring and would be released in September by Caroline Records, a major label the four-piece signed with not long after the letter was sent. The lineup stayed almost exactly the same, except Lisa Roberts would be replaced by Jill Emery. Pretty on the Inside is sludgy and clamorous. It's hardly made for repeated listens. A lot of it is directionless and unpleasant. That was the way Love wanted it. In a 2014 interview with Spin, she clarified that it was supposed to be an example of raw expression. I've always admired the record, mostly because it is so confidently ugly, and because Love's part sardonic, part furious sensibilities that would eventually be refined and lived through this are at their rawest. In spite of its pointed inaccessibility, Pretty on the Inside, while being only a moderate commercial success, was well received. The band also started receiving the attention of bigger labels. One of them was Maverick, a developing company founded by the pop singer Madonna. Most of 1991, though, was spent touring and promoting, not necessarily worrying about signing. Love had a hard time coping with her newfound fame and the rifts that were forming between her and her bandmates. In a 1991 diary entry, she wrote that, despite being the one who did the most talking in interviews, she wasn't as confident as she appeared. She wished she had better relationships with Hole's other members. Quote, "We come off like the most arrogant, pompous, evil fucks that ever walked. I hate being in control." Unquote. Hole eventually lost Jill Emery and Caroline Rue over creative differences. Kristen Pfaff, the bassist for Janitor Joe, and Patty Schemmel, a drummer, respectively replaced them. The band kept moving forward and was signed to Geffen Records' subsidiary label DGC in 1992. By then, Love had married Kurt Cobain, the Nirvana frontman whom she'd first met back in 1990. At the time of the signing, she was also pregnant with their first and only child, Francis Bean. During the pregnancy, Hole recorded its fourth single, Beautiful Son, which was released by DGC in 1993. Here's a clip. When the band was promoting Pretty on the Inside, Love and Erlandson remembered already considering gravitating toward a more commercial sound. Not because they wanted to cater to a specific formula, but because they were interested in being more attentive toward melodics. said Love, quote, "I was very competitive with Kurt because I wanted more melody, but I already wanted that before Live Through This," unquote. Erlandson said that even though Love put pressure on the band to improve upon Nirvana's Nevermind, he was so focused on simply making a good record that he was much more concerned with that album. The period between Pretty on the Inside and Hole's second album was difficult for the band. Because Nirvana was so popular, Love was better known for being Cobain's wife than for being the frontwoman of her own group. It also didn't help when, in 1992, Vanity Fair published a profile in which the writer Lynn Hirschberg insinuates that Love had done drugs, specifically heroin, while pregnant. Hirschberg also characterizes Cobain as a hapless, helpless husband, while Love is a bad-skinned, big-boned hellion who is ruining him. The profile continues to be one of the most infamous pieces of writing entertainment media has ever offered. It is also, I think, the article that best sums up how staunch Nirvana fans and plain old love-hating members of the populace have long looked at the Kurt and Courtney dramas of the 1990s. It certainly contributed to the narrative that Love was a hazard to herself and others, and that she was a harmful influence on Cobain. Thus, it made it difficult for much of the public to see her outside of her marital role and of her image as a drug-addicted hurricane. Patty Schemmel remembers that the celebrity which characterized so much of Love's existence at the time was an obstacle. Since her marriage and life were so constantly written about and analyzed by the masses, Hole eventually had to unofficially come to fight for its right to exist. The production of Live Through This began in October 1993 at Georgia's Triclops Sound Studios, the same place the Smashing Pumpkins, friends of the band, had made Siamese Dream. This was to be the Four Pieces' breakthrough album, and David Geffen, who signed them, threw publicity at it right off the bat. The producers Paul Koldery and Sean Slade, who had previously worked with Dinosaur Jr. and Radiohead, were hired. Schemmel remembers that the band was subjected to a period of adjustment. None had really experienced the perks of working with a major label and a big budget before. Until that time, Schemmel had mostly done things on the DIY scale. Now she suddenly had a person hired specifically to help make sure the sound of her drums were primed for good mixing. Before coming to Georgia, the band had worked hard to prepare. In the previous months, Erlandson and Schemmel intensely practiced in Love and Cobain's home in Carnation, Washington. Love and Cobain themselves were still dealing both with Love's pregnancy and the backlash from the Vanity Fair profile elsewhere. While Schemmel found her time with Erlandson to be lucrative, there was a lot of drinking and partying, too. Love showed up for rehearsals a few days after Erlandson, Schemmel, and Kristen Pfaff set up shop in the studio. During their time in Georgia, Schemmel and Love shared a rental in the suburbs, with Erlandson and Pfaff sharing another. They'd usually head to the studio at noonish, eat lunch, stick around for about 9 hours, then get dinner. Before arriving in Georgia, Love had In Utero, Nirvana's recently released third album, on the brain. According to Schemmel, one of the first things Love did was start fretting over how the drums sounded. Did they sound like Steve Albini drums, or did they sound like Dinosaur Jr.? The Albini thing was important to her, since he was the engineer behind In Utero. Though Schemmel thought her drums sounded great, Love nonetheless was distrustful of both her and Koldery and Slade. She called in Butch Vig, who'd produced Nirvana's Nevermind, to talk about the drum microphones. Then she consulted with the Smashing Pumpkins' Billy Corgan, and then Cobain. After this, she drew up a drum map and showed Koldery and Slade what she was looking for. But both were certain that what they had set up sounded good, so they played part of a rehearsal take of Jennifer's Body, a song which would become the album's fifth track, and isolated the drums. Love ended up liking how it sounded. She made positive comparisons to the work of Jimmy Chamberlain. Then she backed off. The songwriting process was easy, as many of the tracks had either already been written or mostly written. Love remembers writing Doll Parts, which would come to be the album's second single, in Massachusetts in the bathroom of Joyce Linehan, Sub Pop's A&R director at the time. By the time it came to Georgia, the drum parts were basically the only thing that were left. Here's a snippet of that song. Someday you will ache like I ache.
You will.
While hanging out in the now-defunct Los Angeles punk club Jabberjaw, Love wrote the LP's opening track, the rabid, cathartic breakup song Violet. Plump, Jennifer's Body, and Miss World came together earlier on in a practice space in Capitol Hill, a Seattle neighborhood. Gutless was finished just before the band came into the studio. Asking for It was composed entirely in Georgia. I Think That I Would Die, also written around then, was originally called Baby, but had its name changed to the former just after it was finished being recorded. The latter track is my favorite song on the album. Haunted and defined by discord, it makes for the most effective juxtaposition between the placid and the ferocious that the band would often explore. The song's first minute or so is phantasmagoric and confused, but as the song progresses, it gets angrier and angrier. Lyrically, it's repetitive and sort of structureless. Simplistically, it comprises Love chanting about motherhood and her hatred for those, especially women, who think feminism is worthless. It also directly references the cultural criticisms revolving around her ability to parent. The best part of the song is the bridge, which arguably features one of the best literal fuck yous in a song. Supposedly, that fuck you is aimed at Julia Roberts, who once gave an interview wherein she told the writer that she wasn't a feminist. Here's a sample. Despite the songs coming together so smoothly, Slater remembers there not being a larger, overreaching artistic vision. The only memory he has that pertains to this idea is a vulnerable moment during which Love, on the verge of tears, walked into the control room and said, quote, "This album has to go gold," unquote. For much of the recording, everyone was on the top of their game. Pfaff did her bass part so well that her basic tracks were kept in the final recording. Slade said that there was no need for any sort of overdubs because she did such an astounding job the first time around, which rarely happens. Schemmel, while struggling with drug addiction at the time, was comparably on it. She was able to complete her part on Jennifer's Body on the second take, for instance. Here's an excerpt from that song, which certainly does spotlight some of her best work. Slade and Coldery were impressed by how well the band played together, and they were in awe of how confident and clever a songwriter Love was. Coldery has always taken issue whenever the popular rumor that Cobain wrote all the tracks and lived through this is brought up. This is because he saw so many of the songs being completed without him around. Coldery saw Asking For It be built from the ground up in the studio, for example. But speaking of Cobain, Asking For It is also notable for being one of the two songs on the album on which he provides credited backing vocals. During a break from touring with Nirvana, Cobain came to the studio to see how things were coming along. He really liked what he heard and was especially complimentary toward the sound of the drums and the lyrical content. Love wanted Cobain to do more than listen, though. She asked him to sing harmonies. He didn't like this idea since he didn't know the songs very well. But Love wanted at least a little bit of her husband on the record, and so they played some of the tracks a few more times so he could get better acquainted with them. Ultimately, Cobain didn't really offer straightforward harmonizations, but did provide Asking for It and Softer Softest with additional vocals. It's hard to pick him out on first listen, but you can hear Cobain faintly in the background of Softer Softest. Listen closely. Cobain appearing 42 days into the recording process did generate some tension, though. As previously mentioned, he was initially complimentary toward what Coldery and Slade were doing, but the longer he stayed in the studio, the more critical he became. He thought it would be best if the sound on Schemmel's snare were louder, and if Love's vocals were doubled to create more power. Coldery and Slade wouldn't have it. The album was going to be mixed according to how they thought the record should sound, and that was that. Even so, Cobain's time in the studio has always added to the age-old idea that all the songs were written by him. Not the case. This wasn't the only problem production encountered. Though the members were playing cohesively, and even though the actual recording process was pretty harmonious, there were still interpersonal issues. Erlandson and Pfaff were in an on-and-off-again relationship that turned off shortly into production. Pfaff and Schemmel had a friendship that at one point devolved into a make-out session in a club. Coldery and Slade had conflicting viewpoints too. Whereas Coldery thought that what was coming out was kind of awful at first, Slade was mesmerized with what the band was offering, and thought Love was incredibly talented. Love, however, could be hard to work with. She had a difficult time verbally expressing what she was really looking for certain takes, and this led to frequent arguments that sometimes led to ashtrays flying. Love was constantly late, sometimes leaving everyone waiting for 2 hours. She also had a habit of wasting time on the phone. Cobain was on tour and would frequently, and randomly, call, and she'd chat with her friends during inconvenient times. When the 23-year-old actor River Phoenix died shortly into the recording process, for example, Schemmel remembers Love talking to people about it on the phone for almost the entire day. Addiction was a problem, too. On one occasion, Love and Schemmel went to New York to see Nirvana play on Saturday Night Live. Schemmel remembers getting so drunk that she couldn't see straight. Schemmel's problems continued, and shortly after the basic tracks were completed, she experimented with crystal meth. Miss World was recorded while she was high. Recording was finished in November of 1993, and soon after, Hole briefly toured with the Lemonheads for a smattering of shows on the West Coast. The group was trying to get used to playing its new songs live, even though it had not yet gone through the motions of mixing and figuring out cover art. The touring budget was tiny, a van was rented and a small number of supplementary crew members were hired. Love and Schemmel usually shared hotel rooms with the recently split Pfaff and Erlandson in their own. Around this time, Schemmel's and Pfaff's drug problems got worse. At one point before a San Francisco show, Schemmel walked in on Pfaff and a guitar tech smoking heroin off some foil in the bathroom. Not long after that, Schemmel began doing heroin regularly herself. The album was released on April 12, 1994. The cover art was a photo of the model Leilani Bishop in Carrie-esque regalia, taken by Ellen Von Unworth. The back was a simple photo of Love as a child while her family was visiting Springfield, Oregon. The track's titles are printed atop embossing tape. But Live Through This itself was not on most people's minds when it came out, despite getting rave reviews almost immediately. It was put out less than a week after Cobain killed himself, which I won't get too much into during this episode. And so most of the world was both grieving and disgusted with Love for not delaying the LP, and for her behavior at his funeral. Cobain's death made it difficult for Hole to figure out what its next move was going to be. Schemmel remembers everyone in the band going their separate ways for a bit, trying to process what had happened. Pfaff thought about quitting the band to focus on getting off heroin. Schemmel had similar thoughts, and checked into rehab for a short period. On June 13th, Love and her band met to try to figure out what to do. They wanted to take a 2-month-long vacation and then tour in the fall. Pfaff wanted to take an extended holiday. She was intent on going back to Minneapolis, visiting with old friends and doing a handful of shows with her old band, Janitor Joe. This was agreed to. 2 evenings later, Pfaff hosted a going-away party at her home in Capitol Hill. After everyone left, she slipped in the bathtub and injected some heroin. The next morning, she was found dead of an overdose by Erlandson. She, like Cobain, was just 27 years old. This naturally put the band at a standstill. It had already been grieving Cobain, but with Pfaff, the band was directly impacted. Live Through This ended up becoming an eerily appropriate title. Although there were plenty thoughts about going on an even longer hiatus, it was decided that the group was going to push forward and go with the plans it had made in the days before Pfaff's death. Hole understandably canceled the US tour it planned to embark upon in May, but the now three-piece was set on playing shows later in the year. The first would be a gig at the Reading Festival of 1994. In order to do that, though, a bassist would have to be hired. Per the recommendation of Billy Corgan, the band hired the 22-year-old Melissa Oftermaar, who had limited success after forming the Montreal-based alt-rock group Tinker, who frequently opened for the Smashing Pumpkins. At first, Love was skeptical. Oftermaar was attractive and much younger than everyone else. She initially thought that Corgan might be giving her too much credit because there were hearts in his eyes. When Oftermaar rejected offers to join the band at first, Love was intrigued, more so when she actually had to pursue her. When Oftermaar agreed to join, she stuck, and the band's members came to build a rapport with her quickly. She didn't have to audition as Pfaff had. Schemmel remembers being impressed with how calmly Oftermaar came into the situation, which was obviously tense and could intimidate even the most experienced of a musician. In the matter of a few weeks, Oftermaar, who came to Seattle and stayed in Love's guest room, learned the band's songs before they'd head to England for the festival. The Reading performance was nerve-wracking. Schemmel has described it as, quote, fucking scary and emotionally loaded. Love has called it, quote, chaotic, unquote. The latter wore a gold dress and immediately went about provoking the similarly high-strung crowd. Quote, oh yeah, I'm so goddamn brave. Let's pretend it didn't happen. Oh yeah, this is like a hobby for me, unquote. Clearly, Love was just repeating and then reclaiming the words the public and critics were throwing her way for not putting on the grieving wife and bandmate guys in a suitable way. Sarcasm, unsurprisingly, was not exactly the best thing to use at the moment. Disdain, then, for the frontwoman grew. After Reading, the group flew to Ohio, where it would open for the industrial rock group Nine Inch Nails for a few dates. Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails' frontman, has said that during the first show, Love was, quote, completely intoxicated, a fucking mess, unquote. In later years, Love has admitted to that. Nevertheless, Love and Reznor began a relationship not long after. Love's use of drugs and alcohol as a solve for her woes also mushroomed during this time, and her onstage antics and behind-the-scenes behavior started getting increasingly unpredictable and volatile. Infighting became commonplace backstage, especially between Love and Erlandson. The press and the general public were unforgiving. In the first place, they couldn't believe Hole was touring so soon after Cobain and Pfaff died. They abhorred Love's actions, which were pretty unanimously deemed inappropriate. They were shocked she was dating Reznor. There was also the truth that Love, using different usernames, often responded to people's criticisms of her online, and this was also derided once it was discovered. So yes, Love, and Hole in general, was hated by many. But Live Through This was still a critical and commercial success. The band toured for most of the rest of 1994, and for almost all of 1995. And made notable appearances on SNL, MTV Unplugged, the MTV Video Music Awards, and played at the Lollapalooza and Reading Festivals of 1995. The album has gone on to receive approval as a classic by Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, The Village Voice, Spin, Loudwire, and others. I think I have the benefit of discovering and then loving Live Through This so long after all of this happened. I wonder what my reaction to it would have been had I been this age in 1994, and seen all these tragedies and subsequent public appearances in real time. Would I have sympathized with, if not always readily defended, loved the same way I do now? I'd like to think I would. The narrative I've always gone with was that touring and promoting the album, no matter how provocative or contentious it got, was the only way Love would have survived. I cannot imagine what it was like to have your husband kill himself, have your bandmate and friend die of an overdose so soon afterward, and then be accused of being an opportunist and putatively not grieving properly. Certainly, love's tendency to push buttons at shows and during public appearances isn't as easy to defend, and the actions resulting from her drug use during the period were usually hard to watch. But at the same time, I can't, like most, know what it felt like to be Courtney Love during the Live Through This era. Judging by how tangibly sad she appears and sounds in recordings of shows at the time, it's clear to me that pushing through was an act of persistence. Her art was the only thing that would enable her to live through this, even if it was really, really messy. I always think about the first interview Love did after Cobain's death with MTV in 1994, which does a good job somewhat giving us a glimpse inside Love's mindset then.
I gotta go back to work. Yeah. I mean, it's what I do.
Well, no one's gonna hold this against you, I don't think that you're right.
I think they do. I mean, I think that it's expected that I should go close the drapes and you know, shoot drugs or something for, you know, 5 years. But I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I have a baby, I have to make a living, and I, you know, it's the one time I feel really good,
yeah.
You know, is the last couple. I've played 5 times now, and that's basically, other than certain times with my daughter, been the high points of this last period of time.
Hole wouldn't last much longer. The band would make one more album that decade, the poppier, well-received, and pretty good Celebrity Skin in 1998, and then break up in 2002. All, especially Love and Schemmel, would sort out their personal troubles in subsequent years. A comeback record, Nobody's Daughter, was released in 2010, but Because It Sucks is backed by a bunch of members who are not Erlandson, Schemmel, or Oftermar, I usually pretend it doesn't exist, which isn't uncommon for Hole fans to do. Hole released a lot of exceptional and interesting music, but Live Through This is doubtlessly their finest achievement. Take away all the drama circling about its name, and it's still a fantastic record, an unrelenting album's worth of propulsive female frustration that never tires. It is one of the best works to come out of the grunge era. But listen to it with the extraneous dramas in mind, and the album becomes a quintessential product of survival, a work of art that, almost telepathically, assures us that no matter how shitty life gets, and no matter how big our frustrations might be, making it to the other side isn't impossible. Love, who is still so much defined by her being the controversial widow of grunge's figurehead, proved this, warts and all. Thank you for listening to the 4th episode of The Definitives. This episode was narrated, researched, and edited by me, Blake Peterson. If you'd like to know more about me, I recommend heading over to my website, petersonreviews.com, which focuses on cinema, or my Twitter, at Blake W. Peterson. If you want to follow along with the show, next week I will be discussing White Blood Cells by The White Stripes. Thanks for listening.